Wednesday, May 6th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Seoul says it no longer needs to consider joining the US-led Project Freedom after the campaign to free ships in the Strait of Hormuz was suspended. More on that in news briefing. On Wednesday Election Watch, we turn to the Gyeongsang region to take a look at the key races, local issues, polling trends and strategies ahead of the June 3rd local elections. And on Korea Book Club, we'll look at Shift by Cho Ye-un, a dark Korean horror novel blending cults, trauma, mystery and social commentary. Let's start Korea 24 right now. In the wake of an explosion on a South Korean vessel stranded in the Strait of Hormuz, U.S. President Donald Trump has again accused Iran of attacking the cargo ship. And after days of pressuring South Korea to join its efforts to restore safe passage in the vicinity of the critical waterway, Trump has called an abrupt halt to Project Freedom, the U.S. campaign to free stranded ships. South Korea now says it no longer needs to consider whether or not to take part in the operation. For more on the situation in the Middle East and other major headlines of the day, we have now in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-kyung. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Alana.
The 38,000-ton HMM Namu, operated by South Korea's Hyundai Merchant Marine, caught fire after an explosion in the Strait of Hormuz on Monday. South Korea still says it's too early to conclude that the incident was an attack, but President Trump has again said the ship was shot at by Iran. In-kyung, what can you tell us?
Well, that's what Trump said when he spoke to reporters at the White House on Tuesday. Let's take a listen.
By the way, their ship was shot at. They were not in the cavalcade of ships. They decided to go it alone, and their ship got the hell knocked out of it yesterday. But they didn't shoot the ships that were guarded by us, I'll tell you that. We knocked down a lot of missiles. So what happens is that we have a situation where we have total control. As you know, the blockade's been amazing. It's like a...
The HMM Namu is one of 26 South Korean vessels waiting to transit through the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran effectively closed after the war began 2 months ago. The cargo ship was anchored outside the port limits of the Emirati city of Umm al-Quwain. It is being towed and is expected to arrive at the port of Dubai early Thursday. South Korean officials plan to investigate the cause of the explosion, including whether the ship was attacked.
This incident followed an announcement from the U.S. that it would guide stranded ships through the waterway and a subsequent warning from Iran not to attempt to transit the strait without permission.
That's right, and the U.S. leveraged the explosion to step up pressure on South Korea and other U.S. allies to join the efforts to secure navigational freedom in the region. Here's what U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said in a news conference on Tuesday.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Can you share any information regarding the South Korean ship that was reportedly hit by Iran? Is Seoul in contact with the U.S. military about it? And is there any indication that they would heed Trump's call made on social media to join Project Freedom?
We hope so. We're in contact with that ship, CENTCOM, I should say, and the Maritime Coordination Forces are in touch. And I think targeting like that is a reflection of the indiscriminate nature of what Iran is doing. We hope South Korea would step up, just like we hope Japan would step up, just like we hope Australia would step up, just like we hope Europe steps up. But we're not waiting for them to do so. We're looking to set the conditions to hand to them. But the president was clear in his truth message that, hey, this is your ship. You should take part in helping to defend it. We very much hope they do.
But creating confusion just a short while after the presser, Trump said on Truth Social that Project Freedom, the operation to reopen the strait, will be temporarily suspended to see whether a deal can be signed with Iran.
Well, on Tuesday, before the suspension, the presidential office here in Seoul said it's reviewing participation in Project Freedom. In-kyung, what's its stance now?
According to National Security Advisor Wi Seong-nak, there is no longer any need for South Korea to consider whether to take part in it. In a news conference on Wednesday, we also said the presidential office had considered convening a working-level meeting of the National Security Council because it was concerned that the HMM Namu may have been attacked. But he said that after gathering additional information, it became uncertain whether the ship was shot at.
So does this mean that South Korea is stepping back from all maritime security efforts in the region?
Not quite. We noted that while Project Freedom is off the table for now, Seoul is still reviewing the Maritime Freedom Construct. That's a broader Washington-led initiative. He said the safety of international sea lanes and freedom of navigation are extremely important, and that Seoul is comprehensively reviewing all factors related to the Maritime Freedom Construct, including domestic legal procedures.
While things are uncertain in the Middle East, the mood on the Korea exchange today was anything but uncertain. Safe to say it was a historic day for investors.
Absolutely. The Majibak Kospi surged more than 6% on Wednesday to close above the 7,000 mark for the first time ever. The index jumped around 447 points, marking the second largest daily gain on record. It took just 70 days or 47 trading sessions for the Kospi to climb from the 6,000 milestone in late February to surpass 7,000.
And do we know what drove the rally?
Yes, despite sporadic clashes between the U.S. and Iran, a ceasefire is being maintained. This has led to a drop in international oil prices. There's also growing optimism about the earnings of semiconductor-related companies. A 13% surge in Intel on the New York Stock Exchange and a 15% jump in AMD in after-hours trading on strong first-quarter results stimulated buying interest in domestic semiconductor stocks. Samsung Electronics climbed more than 14%, the highest jump in 24 years.
In other headlines, North Korea has revised its constitution to reflect leader Kim Jong-un's two-state doctrine. In-young, what can you tell us?
The Unification Ministry disclosed the North's revised constitution at a press briefing on Wednesday. The new constitution includes a new territorial clause defining sovereignty over only the northern part of the Korean Peninsula and removing provisions related to reunification. All references to inter-Korean kinship and national reunification have also been removed. A clause calling for achieving reunification based on independence, peaceful reunification, and national unity has been deleted, along with references in the preamble that Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il worked to achieve reunification. A newly added territorial clause defines the country's domain as bordering China and Russia to the north and South Korea to the south, though specific land and maritime boundaries were not detailed. But while the revision broadly reflects the two-state framework, it does not explicitly designate South Korea as a hostile state, despite Kim's earlier remarks calling for such language. The amendments have also significantly strengthened the authority and status of the chairman of the State Affairs Commission, that's Kim Jong-un, defining the role as head of state.
In domestic political news, a day ahead of a plenary vote on a motion to revise the country's constitution, President Lee Jae-myung has called on the National Assembly to act promptly and pursue change one step at a time. Ingen, can you explain?
Sure. He said the motion stipulates that the president must obtain parliamentary consent before declaring martial law, and he believes no member of the general public would oppose this provision. The president also said references in the proposed preamble to the constitution to the spirit of the 1980 Gwangju pro-democracy movement and the 1979 Busan Masan pro-democracy uprising would face little opposition from either side of the political aisle.
So the vote is tomorrow. What is the main opposition People Power Party's position?
The PPP reaffirmed its opposition to the amendment. PPP Chairman Jang Dong-hyuk said respecting and upholding the existing constitution is more important than revising its provisions. He said that it is inappropriate to discuss constitutional change when the ruling party is pursuing an unconstitutional special counsel bill aimed at erasing the crimes of President Lee Jae-myung.
On that note, rival parties have clashed over a special counsel bill that could see President Lee cleared of criminal charges his supporters consider groundless. Ingen, give us the details there.
Sure. During a plenary session of the Parliamentary Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, the Democratic Party said the bill aims to investigate alleged prosecutorial misconduct under the Yoon Suk-yeol administration, while the People Power Party argued its intent is to justify dropping charges against Lee. DP lawmaker John Hyun-hee said opposing the special counsel is equivalent to blocking a criminal investigation, adding that abuse of prosecutorial power appears to be involved and it should be examined by a special counsel. People Power Party lawmaker Na Kyung-won criticized the bill as unconstitutional, urging the justice minister to persuade President Lee to scrap it and to call for a veto if it passes parliament.
And that wraps up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, In-kyung, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thanks, Elena.
With the June 3rd gubernatorial and local elections now less than a month away, Korea 24 is touring the country's key battlegrounds, looking at the local issues, candidate lineups, and political dynamics shaping the races. On today's Wednesday Election Watch, we turn to the eastern Gyeongsang region, including the major cities of Daegu, Busan, and Ulsan. We'll look at where the key candidates stand, what recent opinion polls suggest, and what could determine the outcome in one of the country's most politically significant regions. To help us break it all down, we're joined today on the line by Seoul-based journalist Andrew Jung, who'll be with us each week to guide us through the major election battlegrounds. Great to have you with us, Mr. Jung.
Hello.
We're also joined by political commentator and Dongseo University professor Brian Mars, who's based in Busan and will help us understand the key local issues and voter sentiment on the ground. Thanks so much for joining us, Professor Myers.
It's great to be with you.
Well, before we get into the candidates and the latest polling, let's first set the scene and look at why exactly this region matters. Mr. Jung, could you introduce the Gyeongsang region for our listeners, including Daegu, Busan and Ulsan? Which seats are up for grabs and what are the broad political tendencies in these areas?
Right. The Gyeongsang region has a combined population of around 12.3 million people. That makes it the second most populous region in Korea behind the Seoul metropolitan area. The region has tended to lean right throughout the decades. There are many reasons for that, one being the conservative President Park Chung-hee hailing from that region. But there have been also left-leaning candidates who have won seats in the region every now and then, most prominent of which include Presidents Roh Moo-hyun and Moon Jae-in, who both hail from the region as well. This election in June, some prominent seats up for grabs will be the governor's offices in the north and south Gyeongsang provinces, the mayors of Busan, Daegu, Ulsan, and the city of Changwon, which has been overlooked often, but that city also has a population of almost 1 million people. So this region does matter, and it's certainly going to be very important for both of the parties.
So just to briefly summarize, this is, of course, South Korea's second most populous region. It tends to lean right. Professor Myers, you've lived here for a long time in this specific region. Can you tell our listeners about the political characteristics of the major cities in Gyeongsang, in the Gyeongsang provinces and in the region overall?
Yeah, well, I've taught college courses in Daegu and in Gimhae in South Gyeongsang, and I've been teaching in Busan for the past 20 years. And I find the region just fascinating from a political perspective, because actually until the 1960s, it was pretty left wing with a lot of support for social democracy. And as Andrew said, what changed everything was the conservative president, Park Chung-hee, who was from the Daegu area. And he just drastically raised living standards for the entire country, of course, but especially for the southeast, because focusing on exports meant focusing production and development in the region. And there was no trade with China back then, after all. And Park's successor was also from the Daegu area. So to this day, Daegu, if we could start with that city, which is about 2 million people, is the most staunchly conservative city in South Korea. I mean, it hasn't elected a left-wing mayor since the 1950s. But for decades now, the city has been losing jobs, losing young people, it's shrinking. So it feels neglected or maybe even betrayed by the conservative party elite in Seoul. So a left-wing candidate won an assembly seat in Daegu 10 years ago, and that same guy is now running for mayor. Now, to talk about Busan, that's also conservative, especially in Haeundae, the rich part of town. But like Daegu, the city is struggling economically. We have about 3 million people now, but we lose residents every year. Especially the young ones. And there's a running joke, which is that you can sum up Busan in the title of a classic Hemingway novel, The Old Man and the Sea. You know, the idea being there's nothing in Busan but old people in the ocean. So there's anger in Busan, too, at the conservative party elite in Seoul. And we did have a left-wing mayor before, plus some districts in the north and the west. In other words, the working class part of town, which is where I live, have elected progressives to the National Assembly, including Moon Jae-in. Now, of the three cities, the big cities in the Gyeongsang region, Ulsan is the smallest. It's about a million people. But due to the auto and ship industry, it's doing a lot better economically than either Busan or Daegu. And it usually elects conservative mayors. But the interesting thing about Ulsan is that because of all the industrial workers there, there's strong support for the far left pro-unionist Progressive Party, which is considered radical here in South Korea. In fact, one district elected a Progressive Party man to the National Assembly a few years ago. So to sum everything up, I would say the Southeast is still conservative, but not as monolithically conservative as the southwest of the country, the Chulla region, is monolithically left-wing.
Mm-hmm. So overall, a conservative region, in particular Daegu, of course, which is famously conservative. Let's now zoom in on the key battlegrounds, the candidates in the region. Mr. Jung, what are the most fiercely contested elections in the region, and who are running in the areas?
I think it would be only fair to start that assessment in the city of Daegu, where the primaries for the Conservative Party became a little noisy. The winner of that primary ended up being Choo Kyung-ho, the former deputy prime minister in the Yoon Suk-yeol administration. He was also a member of parliament. He will face off against Kim Boo-geum, another Daegu native and also a former deputy prime minister during the Moon Jae-in administration. Both men are from Daegu. The liberals have been the traditional underdogs in that city, as we've been discussing. But Kim Boo-geum has won a parliamentary seat in that city in 2016. So he has more of a chance than perhaps other liberal peers in his party. Other candidates running in that city will include the right-leaning Reform Party's Lee Soo-chan, the independent Kim An-gu, who is a former member of the main Conservative People Powers Party. He has protested the results of the primary. He will be running as an independent candidate. And we move on to the city of Busan, where Chun Jae-soo will be running for the Democratic Party as a candidate for the mayor of the second most populous city. He will be running against Park Hyung-jun, the incumbent mayor, who will be seeking to defend his seat. There is also a Reform Party candidate running there as well. He will be Jung Hee-han. And then the city of Ulsan, Kim Sang-uk will be representing the Democratic Party. Kim Sang-uk is a former conservative who was one of the few conservatives to condemn former President Yoon Suk-yeol's coup attempt in December 2024. He was also one of the few who voted to impeach President Yoon, and he is now running as a candidate for the other side, the Democratic Party, in the city of Ulsan. He will be facing off against the incumbent, the conservative Kim Doo-geum. In the north Gyeongsang province, you have the incumbent, again, conservative Lee Cheol-woo, who will be facing off against Oh Jung-gi of the Democratic Party. Mr. Oh is a former Blue House official who served in the Moon Jae-in administration. This will be the seventh time that he's running for an office in the province. He lost six previous elections. And in the South Gyeongsang province, we have a rematch of the prior election where Park Wan-soo, the incumbent, will be facing off against Kim Kyung-soo, a former governor of the same region. And we also have a parliamentary by-election in the city of Busan, a district in the north part of the city. We'll have to elect a lawmaker. The three candidates who appear to be likely candidates to run in that part of the country is Han Dong-hun, a famous name here. He will be running as an independent. He will face off against Ha Jung-woo, a member of the Democratic Party. We also have a third candidate running in that part of town by the name of Park Min-sik. He will be representing the main Conservative Party, the People Power Party. So a lot going on in the region and not limited to local offices. We also have a major parliamentary seat up for grabs.
Professor Myers, of those races, which do you think will matter the most in shaping the overall election narrative? And to frame that, what do you think would count as a satisfactory result for each side? Is this as simple and black and white as win or lose and who gets the most votes?
Well, the by-election in Busan's North District is getting a lot of media attention, but I think the average South Korean looking at the newspaper the day after the elections is just going to be checking who won the big mayoral races around the country. Now, I think a ruling party victory in Ulsan is pretty much baked into everybody's expectation, as long as the left-wing candidates unite there. So the drama is revolving around Daegu and Busan. And I think the ruling party can be happy if it flips either of those cities. But winning Daegu would really make history. And mayors get a lot of funds that they can channel to NGOs. So a left-wing mayor could create a kind of NGO ecosphere, which might keep it a swing city for a long time. And that would force the Conservative Party to spend more resources there in general and presidential elections. On the other hand, I think that if the ruling party candidates end up losing in Daegu and Busan after being pretty well ahead in the polls for quite a while there, this will be seen as a big disappointment. Now, as for the Conservative opposition, expectations were so low for it only a month or two ago that even if it only holds on to Daegu, I think it'll be pretty happy at this point. And if it holds on to Busan as well, it'll be claiming victory. Although, you know, even that would not change the fact that the People Power Party is basically turning into a regional party, you know, a southeastern party.
So Daegu really in particular, one to watch for June 3rd. Let's talk about some of the issues that could actually move voters. Mr. Jung, what are the key election issues in the region and what are the key pledges of candidates?
So to start again in Daegu, I think fundamentally the election, not only in Daegu, but other parts of the country will be a referendum on the Lee Jae-myung administration and the two major parties. But in Daegu, I think campaign promises from both sides didn't sound too different on the surface, but there were some important nuances that made them different. The conservative Choo Kyung-ho has pledged to make Daegu the startup capital of Korea by creating a large fund. He has also pledged to convince the central government to spend more money in the city, partly by helping expand or acquire a new airport for the city. The liberal Kim Bu-kyum has pledged to double the city's GRP, the gross regional product, from 74.5 trillion won, which is around $50 billion, to 150 trillion won, which would be around $100 billion. He has also pledged to create a net 100,000 jobs. He has also pledged to attract tech companies to the city focused on AI and other key tech issues. So the two candidates are both pledging to create more jobs, create a bigger economy. I think they are different in how they're approaching that mechanism. Going to the city of Busan, so the major candidates being Park Kyung-jun of the Conservative Party, the mayor, the incumbent mayor, who will be challenged by Chun Jae-soo, the liberal candidate. So Park has said that he wants to go ahead with a cultural center, one of the main pledges that he made in the previous election when he got elected. This cultural center will be a quasi-replica of a famous cultural center in Paris by the name of Pompidou. I don't know if I got the pronunciation right. Forgive listeners may have to forgive me for that. But so he has pledged to create a cultural center among an array of other pledges. He wants to go ahead with it. Chun Jae-soo, his challenger, says that's a little too much. Chun Jae-soo has said that he wants to spend the same money on subsidies for fuel, electricity, consumption, something that he says will make a real difference in the lives of the people in the city. The conservatives have countered that by saying that the center will serve a longer term purpose for the city by helping increase tourism and helping increase consumption in the city. AI and economic reforms also hang high in the broader Gyeongsang region. So a lot of issues, but the same topics appear to be popping up in different cities within the region, that being against the economy, AI, new jobs, what are candidates doing to bring in more money?
Mm-hmm. Professor Myers, we've touched on the fact that this region is traditionally and historically a conservative region, although the tide may be somewhat changing. How can ruling and opposition candidates appeal, you know, beyond their core supporters in these regions? And what do voters most want to hear from them?
Well, the main concerns of people in the Southeast are very different from the concerns of people in Seoul. You know, in Seoul, the main issue is the runaway cost of housing. And I think that's why so many young voters in Seoul support the conservative opposition. Whereas down in the provinces where real estate is more affordable or it's even becoming cheaper in some places, the key question is really how to revitalize local industries and how to attract investment, particularly in order to keep young people from leaving. You know, my students in Busan, they love the weather and the beaches. It really is a beautiful city, and we're breaking tourism records this year. But about half of my students are resigned to the fact that after graduation, they're going to have to look for jobs elsewhere, either in Seoul or overseas. And Gyeongsang people have been hearing empty promises from their politicians for decades, so they no longer expect very much. But I think the ruling party candidates have an advantage now in that they can at least say, hey, we've got a left-wing president in Seoul, we have a left-wing central government, so naturally we can work better with it and we can get more advantages for our city than a right-wing candidate can, especially now that there's so much ill will between the left and the right. So conversely, I think that opposition candidates are going to have to show either that they are moderate enough to be able to work with the Lee administration, or, and this is more difficult, that they can rejuvenate their cities without relying on handouts from the central government.
Well, let's now talk about the current state of the race and, of course, what the numbers are telling us. Mr. Jung, give us the latest results from the polls.
Right. The polls appear to show an upper hand for the ruling party, as we all suspect. In Busan, the Democratic Party's Chun Jae-soo appear to have a big lead over the incumbent conservative mayor Park Hyung-jun. Chun had a support of 48% of respondents in a recent survey, while Park had a support of 34%. So he had a plus 10% differential. That particular poll was conducted by the Korea Research International and had a confidence level of 95% with a margin of error of 3.1%. That survey contacted little over 1,000 adults living in Busan from May 1 to May 2. We go to Daegu. I think there was a upper hand for the ruling party, which, if they win, would be an upset for sure. Kim Bugyeom, the liberal candidate running as mayor in the city, had a support level of 41% from respondents in a recent survey, while his opponent, Chu Kyung-ho, had a support level of 36% from the same survey. That particular survey was conducted by Ipsos, had a confidence level of 95% with a margin of error of 3.5%, and it contacted 801 adults from May 1 to May 3rd. So the left party having a lead of sorts, according to these polls, over the conservative party in both cities and across the region.
And finally, beyond the polls, there's the question of strategy. Professor Myers, what do the ruling and opposition parties need to do from here to win this region?
Well, you know, if I'd been asked a few weeks ago, I would have said they need to nominate fresh faces and younger faces, particularly for the Southeast. But the candidates have all been nominated now, and most voters know which camp they're going to vote for. So both sides are trying to win over the undecideds, who make up, say, 15 to 20% of the voters. And those voters do not want to hear extreme rhetoric from either side. So they don't want to hear the ruling party talk about purging insurrectionists, and they don't want to hear the conservative opposition acting as if the country were about to, you know, slide into Venezuelan-style socialism. And I think they're a little bit tired of hearing about grandiose infrastructure plans as well. And they've been playing quite a role, especially in Busan. Now, you can connect Busan, Ulsan, and Changwon more tightly to each other in some way or another by spending a lot of tax money and disrupting traffic for years. But is that really going to attract investment and new residents? Now, that's what people are asking. Now, in Busan especially, we have an awful lot of small business owners who are already struggling for survival. They don't know how they're going to make it into next year. So rather than hear about grandiose projects and buildings that'll be ready in 5 or 10 years, they'd rather hear humble proposals that are realizable in the short term. So my advice to both of the big parties would be, stop treating the other side as an enemy of democracy, cool it with that kind of propaganda, and instead talk positively about your own camp's core values and make your proposals as concrete and practical and as focused on the short and middle term as possible.
And that's where we'll leave it for today's Wednesday Election Watch. A big thank you to journalist Andrew Jung for walking us through the key races and polling. Thank you so much, Mr. Jung.
Thank you.
And thank you to Professor Brian Myers of Dongseo University for your insights. Always great to have you with us, Professor Myers.
My pleasure.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index spiked 447.57 points, or 6.45% on Wednesday, to close at 7,384.56. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 3.57 points, or 0.29%, to close at 1,210.17. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Elena.
Daniel, let's get right into it. What's our starting point for today?
Authorities announced Seoul's fine dust levels dropped significantly. Last year, in fact, the capital saw a huge turnaround compared to 2 decades ago.
It's fantastic news, something that's particularly noticeable on a beautiful day like today with lovely blue skies. Let's dive straight into the figures so we can learn more about the welcome progress being made over the years.
Sure thing. The Seoul Metropolitan Government said Wednesday the annual average concentration of ultra-fine dust, or PM2.5, fell 40% from 30 micrograms per cubic meter in 2006 to 18 in 2025. Fine dust, or PM10, dropped 47% over the same period from 60 micrograms to 32. Days with concerning PM2.5 levels, or days with concentrations at or above 36 micrograms per cubic meter, fell from 108 in 2006 to just 32 last year. Days with clean air or below 15 micrograms more than double, from over double to over 180 during the same period.
And do we know what are some of the key factors contributing to this turnaround?
The conversion of buses, to name one, they were becoming more eco-friendly and played a big role. Between 2006 and 2014, Seoul converted about 8,900 diesel buses to natural gas and other cleaner alternatives. Today, electric buses make up about 23% of all buses roaming the capital. Green improvements made to aging diesel vehicles also help. They were fitted with filters, and operators were encouraged to scrap such buses early for subsidies.
Well, it's fantastic that those changes are making a difference. Daniel, what about other pollutants aside from fine dust? Are we seeing similar improvements there?
Unfortunately, there were some pollutants that not only persist but grow. Seoul's ozone levels spiked more than 48% between 2015 and 2025, all the way to 0.0326 parts per million. This could be particularly dangerous to children and the elderly, who are more vulnerable to its effects on the eyes and respiratory tract. The city plans to inspect more than 1,000 facilities, including gas stations, painting shops, and dry cleaners, and also devise source-specific reduction measures. Also, alongside this, they will conduct public awareness campaigns.
Well, hopefully things continue to move in the right direction. Let's move on to our next story now.
A humanoid robot named Kabi was the center of attention at an ordination ceremony at the Jogye Temple in downtown Seoul this afternoon.
Okay, must be a very unique experience, to say the least, for both the robot and the human humans watching. Daniel, tell us more about this ceremony.
So this is Kabi's initiation into Buddhism, something monks had to take a long time to carefully review, since they hope the ceremony will hold symbolic value for all of human-robot relations. The 1.3-meter tall humanoid robot did everything a human monk would do, except for burning an incense stick near his arm. For that part, a monk put a sticker on Kabi instead. But for all intents and purposes, Kabi is now a monk of the Jogye Temple, and robot Kabi was dressed in traditional monk robes, pledged commitment to Buddhism in what's called a precept ceremony.
This kind of pledge is normally taken by human postulants when they are becoming monks. Gabi completed the spoken ritual with human monks as witnesses, and Gabi swore to follow five vows of Buddhism or precepts.
Well, I'm curious about these five vows. Can you tell us more about those?
So for Gabi, the five vows were adapted from traditional Buddhist values and then specially designed for robot followers by the order's monks in consultation with artificial intelligence platforms. They include respecting life, both human and non-human, not harming others, listening to humans, being forthright or truthful, and using only as much energy as needed to not overcharge.
Do we know what other events Gabi the Buddhist robot will be taking part in the future?
Well, Gabi will be a part of the traditional lantern ceremony for Buddha's birthday, which falls on May 25th for Korea this year. And Gabi won't be alone. Three other robots will be joining in too. A venerable Sungwon in charge of Jogye Order's cultural affairs said they had been planning to bring in robot members to their order since the model first appeared 3 years ago, and expressed hope such ceremonies can become a model for human-robot relations, not just for Buddhism, but throughout human society. A lot of thought went into various steps in Gabi's introduction into Buddhism, even in coming up with the perfect name. The name Gabi, it's partly from the Korean word jabi, which means mercy.
Well, it's a very modern twist on some very old traditions there. Let's now turn to our final story of the day.
Competition heats up and anticipation builds as we approach the June 3rd local elections here in South Korea. KBS announced big plans to provide a one-of-a-kind live coverage on that day.
Okay, and what will make this coverage stand out from previous years? Did the station choose any kind of special venue?
Yes, they did. For the first time ever, it will be held at the National Museum of Korea, a venue chosen as it reflects well the core message of KBS's election coverage special, compiling or gathering wisdom to take a great leap forward. The museum, a space that compiles various elements of Korea's past and present, has become a core element in elevating K-culture to new global heights. Having a record-breaking year in 2025 with over 6.5 million visitors, ranking third in global museum survey, among other accomplishments last year.
Aside from this symbolic venue and a great choice, what else can viewers look forward to?
A special set named K-Zone will be set up with the Geolmod, or the mirror pond, at the National Museum of Korea as the backdrop. While the pond is designed to reflect the main building and neighboring Namsan Mountain, it will also serve as a symbol of reflection of the will of the voters. To provide a coverage like no other, AR technology will be implemented. The latest camera equipment will be deployed, including cranes and drones, to make sure this is a very exciting event for all.
Well, the backdrop, that state-of-the-art technology, it'll certainly make for a grand broadcast. But of course, Daniel, at the heart of it all, this is still election coverage. So when it comes to things like data and, of course, the results and the real-time updates, what kind of upgrades have been made on that front?
Well, for starters, at the main studio, a gigantic display will be set up measuring 7 meters high and 30 meters wide, as well as displays on the floor, all the better to provide wider and more detailed coverage and updates on the numbers. AI, video, and other visual tech will be used to provide various data and help viewers not just keep updated on the big picture, but also zoom in on specific area, candidate, as well as the ups and downs in fiercely contested battlegrounds.
And that's where we'll wrap up today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
For Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. And in the studio with us today is Julia Ratti, a translator from Korean into Italian and English. Julia, hello and welcome back.
Hi, Alana. Thank you for having me again.
Julia, what do you have for us today?
Oh, yes. Well, as your resident horror stan, today I would like to introduce you to my favorite Korean author. I brought with me Shift in Korean, a novel written by Cho Yeon and translated by Yeon Jung. I'm very happy to talk about this author because, as I said, I really love her work, and I'm also a big fan of the UK publisher. However, I do want to say that you have to be a bit patient until you can read Shift, because it's coming out on May 29th. though it's already available for pre-order on Home for Stars website.
Okay, so definitely one to look forward to, especially for horror fans like yourself. Yeah. And it's always exciting, of course, to get new Korean fiction in translation, even if we do have to wait just a little bit longer. All right, let's delve into the author first. Julia, what can you tell us about Cho Yeon's career and works?
Well, compared to the two authors I introduced to the Korea Book Club previously, which were novelist Kang Ji-young and poet Lee Min-ha, Cho Yeon is a few years younger than them. In fact, she has started her career in 2016 by winning the second time lit fiction contest hosted by Golden Bow Books with the short story Overlap Knife Knife, which is included in the collection Cocktail Love Zombies, and has also been adapted into a drama for KBS in 2023. In the same year, she also won the 4th Kyobo Mungo Story Award with Shift. And then in 2019, she published the new Seoul Park Jelly Massacre, also translated by Yewon Jung in 2024 for Hunt for Star. And I think Barry Welsh reviewed it for the Korea Book Club back when it came out. And then in 2020, Cho Yeon published her bestseller, Cocktail of Zombies, followed by Tropical Night, Teddy Bear는 죽지 않아, which is upcoming in English with the title Teddy Bears Never Die, but we'll talk about this book in a different episode of the Korea Book Club. And finally, 적상 가오게 류령, The Haunting of the Enemy's House, and 치즈 이야기, Cheese Story, which is a collection of 7 or 8 short stories.
So she's had quite a prolific run in a relatively short time. And of course, great to see more of her work being translated and introduced to international readers. And Julia, knowing that you're such a devoted reader and a translator yourself, it feels like a massive endorsement to call her your favourite author. So what is it about Cho Yeon's writing that stands out to you?
So for listeners who also appreciate the horror genre as much as I do, my love for this author won't come as a surprise, like, at all. Cho Yeon has a vast readership, and she writes across many genres, from science fiction to fantasy, horror, and thriller. But the common denominator is that all of her stories are always engaging and eerie. Mm. My first encounter with this author was through Cocktail Love and Zombies, which is a collection of 4 short stories ranging from female killer versus male victim, a little bit like Gone Girl, to a swamp ghost falling in love with a forest ghost, and a zombie epidemic solved by a Cheetah ancestral rite. All of Cho Yeon's work is a lively blend of deceptive sweetness and classic horror tropes, with a generous sprinkle of body horror. Her style feels very modern and rooted in current issues. For example, the swamp ghost story that I just mentioned is an eco-feminist tale that criticizes capitalism and male greed. I translated it, and it's available in English in the anthology I Was Alive Here Once.
So I've heard of Cho Yeon before, of course, and I know she has a huge fandom, as you mentioned, you know, her fast readership. I've seen her books in bookstores. But Julia, what do you think, you know, makes her so successful?
I think that part of her success, not only in Korea but also abroad, is due to the unexpected twist that she brings to the horror genre, effectively breaking what could be a predictable pattern. The idea of solving a zombie apocalypse with the Cheetah ancestral rite is, I think it's a fun twist, and also adds a folkloristic layer as well. In another book, Tropical Night, my favorite story is 나쁜 꿈과 함께, along with the Bad Dreams, which is about the night hag who feels lonely. Again, you see how she incorporates softness into a monstrous character, making us empathize with it.
I think that's really fascinating. So she's not just writing horror for, you know, shock value, but really using the genre to explore deeper themes and emotions. And it sounds like those unexpected twists you mentioned, like solving a zombie outbreak through a traditional ritual, really seem to set her work apart. And let's talk about the novel now. What's the plot of Shift? Or as much as you can tell us without spoiling it, of course.
Right. So Shift revolves around a religious cult that 10 years before the events of the novel promised to cure their Sikh church members after receiving hefty donations, of course. The main characters are Yi Chang, a detective whose family belonged to the cult when he was a child and whose sister the cult actually saved from an incurable illness. The second main character is Lan, a young man who as a child was exploited and imprisoned by the two cult leaders alongside his brother Chan. 10 years later, after Chan's murder at the hands of a desperate churchgoer and the disappearance of the two cult leaders, Yi Chang's and Lan's paths finally cross as Yi Chang is investigating the mysterious murder of a man who was stabbed multiple times but found covered in someone else's blood.
It's a really gripping setup. My interest is piqued already. Both a mystery at the center and then these deeply, you know, personal connections to the cult. It also seems like the story is exploring some darker themes around faith, exploitation, trauma, while still keeping that suspenseful and investigative thread running through it. I'm dying to know a little bit more, Julie. What else can you tell us without, of course, giving away any spoilers?
Much like the new Seoul Park Jelly Massacre, Shift offers a strong social commentary centered on children and on the violence and trauma that they experience at the hands of adults. It also delves into obsession, loneliness, greed, and altruism. The narrative has a non-linear structure that interweaves Yi Chang's and Lan's points of view, enhancing the foreboding vibes and deepening the novel's explorations of its characters, especially Lan. Through both characters' memories, we uncover the secret of that mysterious cult, a secret that is also connected to an evil, corrupt politician, and that at the same time represents the only salvation for Yi Chang's sick niece. The translation reads really smoothly, which is expected, since Yi Wenzhong is a veteran who has translated dozens of books, and the prose is straightforward and impactful, with no flowery sentences, just as it is in the Korean. And I think it's also one of the aspects of why Choi Yoon is so appreciated by readers. Another aspect I enjoyed while reading the book is the body horror, which frequently appears in Choi Yoon's work. Here, it manifests in visceral descriptions of wounds and illnesses. If the new Seoul Park Jelly Massacre felt like a whimsical yet tragic ride, I think Shift is more of a bleak descent into the evil that resides in the human heart. I think readers will really have to brace themselves for the ending.
Right, it sounds intense and much darker in tone compared to some of her other work, one that leaves a strong impression, especially if readers need to brace themselves for that ending. Do you happen to have the book with you today?
Of course. I had to show you in person. I'm obsessed with covers, though I wish I weren't as superficial. And I have to say that I was over the moon when I saw that for their second Choi Yoon book, Hunt for Star decided to commission the Shift cover to the same Korean artist that created the cover for the new Seoul Park Jelly Massacre. The artist's name is Chiuk Che, or Choi. They're on Instagram. And in both covers, there is a sticky substance where in the first one, in the new Seoul Park, it drips over a doll's face, while in Shift, it drips over two featureless human figures lying on the beach.
Okay, so I think the colours are gorgeous. It's one of those ones where I think you'd be attracted by the colours. And then when you look a bit closer, that weird, sicky, slimy substance would definitely give you pause for thought. But definitely one I think that you would stop and look twice at.
Yeah, I definitely love the colours. But I also have to say that I love the goopiness of both covers. So, yeah, for me, they're like, if I would see them on a shelf, I would buy them right away. And then when it comes to like the illustration itself, for the background of the new Seoul Park Jelly Massacre, we have like an amusement park because that's the setting of the novel. And the same thing happens also in Shift, because we see a beach, which is also one of the settings of the book. But also we see two human figures that could be the brothers, Chan and Lan, or a visualization of the illnesses described in the book. But I can't say more or I risk giving out spoilers.
Okay, you've given us enough, Julia. Well, with its eerie atmosphere and unexpected twists, I think this is one for readers who enjoy stories that both unsettle and stay with you long after the final page. That was Julia Ratty with Shift by Cho Ye-un, a dark and thought-provoking novel blending horror with social commentary. Thank you so much, Julia.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's Korea 24. Be sure to join us again tomorrow for more news, analysis and stories from Korea and beyond. I'm Alana Hill. Take care and goodbye.